Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Yasmeen Ammer, in for Tiziana Deering.
The following episode depicts violence and murder. Listener discretion is advised.
That is the opening line of a new true crime podcast out of Worcester, exploring more than 70 unsolved murder and missing persons cases in that city. The podcast is called Unsolved Worcester, and it comes at a kind of interesting moment in the world of true crime. And we mean it. Please be advised, this conversation will feature some difficult topics, including murder. Joining us now is Patrick Sargent, founder of This Week in Worcester and creator and showrunner of the podcast Unsolved Worcester. Patrick, great to have you.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
And also here, Laurel Onert, assistant teaching professor in the program in Media and Screen Studies at Northeastern University. And she's currently building a new class on true crime. Laurel, so great to have you too.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
And I want to start with you, Patrick, because I want to know, what was your goal in creating this true crime podcast all about one city, Worcester?
Sure. Well, I'm from Worcester. And as you mentioned, I do own and operate This Week in Worcester.com. And typically every year, we highlight the unsolved murder cases just in listicle form, no real deep dive into them. But we always do tons and tons of page views for it. People are always super interested in it. And there really isn't a place or a platform where all these cases exist and people can go in and find information for them. The Worcester Police Department's list is minimal at best. I mean, it has just the straight facts for each case, but that's really about it. So what we wanted to do was take each case, tell each story, give a bit more background than you would normally find anywhere else, and do it in a way that people can, you know, listen or watch within 20 to 25 minutes.
And I do want to know, was part of your goal to maybe get listeners involved, or was it more so just shining a light on all these unsolved cases?
Both, I would say. You know, we definitely want to shine a light on each of those cases and each of the victims and their stories and their lives. But, you know, what we've seen and the response that we've gotten from our listeners and viewers has been completely positive for the most part. But they all want to share their theories, share their ideas, send us tips. So it's been a lot of back and forth with people we've never met before, a lot of, you know, strangers coming through the woodworks to share what they know. But at the same time, we've had a lot of families reach out, like families of the victims, which completely surprised us. It could have gone either way in our minds, you know, before we launched, whether or not they would like the podcast, whether or not they wanted their family members' stories to be told. But 10 out of 10, you know, 100% of the people, the families that have reached out to us, all support what we're doing. And, you know, they're fans of the content that we're putting out.
Yeah, I want to talk more about that later. But Laurel, just to go to you, Patrick's show has gotten, as you just heard him, it's gotten pretty big, pretty fast, and they've had 70,000 streams across the first 10 episodes. Knowing what you know about true crime, does it surprise you that this hyper-local true crime podcast has been this popular?
No, because true crime has become an extremely popular medium, especially on the medium of a podcast. And so it's not surprising to me that people would find it. I think that since Serial, we've had the Serial effect, right, where I think Spotify has over 1,000 true crime podcasts airing right now.
So. I'd be shocked if it was just 1,000, honest. Yeah.
So it's extremely popular.
So, and Patrick, I want to know what kinds of stories you've been telling. What are the common threads in some of these cases besides being from Worcester?
What we're seeing as far as a theme goes is almost, you know, I would say 80 85% of the cases that we've researched already and have planned for season 2 and season 3 is that police always seem to believe that the victim knows their killer. It's almost across the board that's the case. And then It's just a matter of, you know, they can't obviously mark down who it is, or, you know, there's very little to go on. But the constant theme has always been, we think they knew who the person was. You know, a lot of the times people get, you know, especially it's young women in a lot of these cases, and they're getting to the car of somebody they know, or they're going out with somebody that, you know, they're leaving their homes or their schools or their work, and they're, you know, victims of, you know, these murders, and it's typically somebody they know, and that's really the constant theme. For season two, which we're launching Thursday, we've streamlined it a little bit. We've kind of connected the dots from one case to the next through those 10 episodes. And the theme for season two is the Canal District in Worcester, where everyone probably knows at this point is Polar Park, that area. And, you know, I think 8 out of the 10 cases happen within a square mile of Polar Park and the Canal District and Green Island neighborhood. So that's kind of the theme we're working with starting Thursday.
So let's see if we can talk about one case in particular. Patrick, I know the story of Nereida Melendez touched you personally, and could you just briefly walk us through that case?
Sure. Nereida Melendez was found dead on June 5th, 1989, on Bell Hill, which is right on Belmont Hill near Bell Pond in Worcester. And she was reported missing the night before, so June 4th, 1989, from a high school graduation. She never showed up. She was a senior at North High. She was ready to graduate, and she didn't show up. So, you know, kind of her family went out the next day and searched everywhere. Her purse was found on Bell Hill.
We actually have a cut from.
Oh, great.
From,
yes.
So let's play that.
Sure.
5 days after her body was found on Bell Hill, Nereida Melendez was buried wearing her graduation cap and gown at St. John's Cemetery on Cambridge Street in Worcester. Over 300 people attended Nereida's funeral, and many of her North High classmates showed up in their graduation gowns. As Nereida's casket was brought forward up the aisle of Our Lady of Fatima, pomp and circumstance was played in the church.
It's a really gutting scene. It's something that was supposed to be celebratory turned so tragic. But how did you hold that? How did you feel when you were recording it?
You know, it's difficult just to write these things. And Dan does a wonderful, Dan Yeager, our host, does a wonderful job of, in his timing and, you know, his pattern of being able to tell these stories. But writing it and researching it, you know, it's just, you find out one thing after another. You know, you think the story's coming to an end, and then you know, the police will come up with another piece of evidence down the road. And so putting this episode together, it was super tough. And I also knew that her story deserved 2 episodes and not just one. So we did a 2-part episode for Nereida just to really give her life, you know, the shine that it needed. And she had such promise at such a young age that she deserved as much time as possible to tell her story.
Mm, and Laurel, I'm wondering if you got a chance to listen to Nereida Melendez's story and the podcast, and I just wonder what is sticking out to you from this podcast. What kinds of things are you thinking about as you think about this hyper-local true crime podcast?
I did listen, and I agree. You know, it's really touching and heart-wrenching story. And what sticks out to me, because I'm a media scholar, is thinking about placing it within a broader history of true crime media. And for me, it's an interesting hybrid because it's both the kind of unsolved mysteries, television type, sensationalized sometimes media, but then it also has this element of seriousness and personal quality that podcast has, where there's a personal relationship between the journalist who's investigating, or in this case, the person who's telling the stories, and the stories that are being told. And so I think it's more personal than some of the TV genres that it draws from.
So in that, speaking of just being personal, so in preparation for this conversation, one of our producers called Peter Vasquez, that's Nereida's brother, and he had this to say.
No, Worcester Unsolved, I think, is great. It was a long time coming, not just for my sister's case, but all the other unsolved cases in Worcester. And I just, it baffles my mind how many there are. What's frustrating to me now that I know about that, it really upsets me that, you know, how are the Worcester detectives, you know, in the DA's office, how are they going about getting these solved? That's my frustration with that whole thing.
Patrick, what's it like to hear that, get that reaction from the brother?
Oh, Peter's right, and we had the opportunity to interview Peter right after Thanksgiving. Mm. It's actually, his episode dropped today, our interview with him, but he's 100% right. I mean, what are they, what are the police and the DA doing? And especially at this point, I mean, his sister was murdered over 30 years ago. So what more can they do at this point? It's a good question.
We did reach out to the Worcester Police Department and the district attorney's office, and both declined to address any specific case. The Worcester police did say that they place a high priority on solving homicide cases to bring justice to the perpetrators and closure to the family of the victims. But Laurel, just back to you, not all families of victims are happy to have their relative stories told in this way, but I want to know if you think there's a blueprint for doing it well.
Oh, that's a good question. I think the best way to do it well is with permission. I mean, you know, just asking them and finding out what they want told. I think questions about how you approach the topic, is it voyeuristic? Is it morbid curiosity? Or is it an investment in truth and justice? I think these are all important. And also, not, you know, being explicit about your perspective and the way that you are approaching the topic without necessarily and being open to having your mind changed by evidence. I think that's important as well.
It's interesting you say that, because there's been so many instances where I had to just drop a true crime podcast because it did feel voyeuristic. I couldn't keep listening to it because I just didn't know how the family would feel about it. Just to let listeners know, we're speaking to Laurel Onert, assistant teaching professor at Northeastern University. She's building a new class all about true crime, and Patrick Sargent, showrunner of the podcast Unsolved Worcester, which is about to start its second season. So, Patrick, I want to play a cut that gets to this the local piece from this. It's from episode 7. It's on the murder of Paul Majorana.
For as large a city as Worcester is, many people from here will tell you it's much more like a small town. Everyone knows everyone, or everyone knows someone that knows you. And everyone from Worcester defends this city vehemently, and many from here keep this city's secrets safe.
You grew up in Worcester, but what did you learn about your own city doing this podcast?
Everything seems to be a bit more connected than you think. There are a lot of familiar names that come up more than once. You know, it's just, if you go to episode, I think, 6 and 7 of season 1, there are several names that come up, and I'll share this story quickly. In episode 2 of season 2, the suspect that's arrested for the murder of Phyllis Ann Morissette in 1968, the suspect just happened to be my father's baseball coach when he was 12 years old, and my father was going to go to practice, but practice was canceled because the coach was arrested.
And you didn't expect that connection.
Oh, I had no idea until I was telling him the story.
Wow. So I want to know, Laurel, so why was this a good time to visit true crime from an academic perspective? Why are you building this class?
Well, I think a lot of people are asking about it and talking about it. YouGov recently did a poll about people's opinions about true crime to see, you know, a lot of people are arguing that true crime has a negative effect on society. And so I was trying to gauge what those effects are or how people perceive those effects. And also, I think there's some interesting connections to the spread of misinformation and conspiracy theories online. I think a lot of the way that people engage with true crime media and social media mirrors a lot of the way that they engage with, you know, political controversy and other types of misinformation or disinformation online. And so I think to understand how people engage with true crime can actually give us some insight into how people engage with these other types of political discourse or conspiracy theory.
And Patrick, follow up on that, because how are people engaging? You said you've had people reach out. Are people giving you tips, or is part of you worried about podcast listeners taking it too far?
Oh, certainly. Yes, absolutely. And that's, knock on wood, that hasn't happened yet. But what we do get is, you know, a lot of emails, a lot of messages via YouTube or Facebook Messenger telling us, you know, who's responsible for the murder and where we should look and how we should look into it. And our response is always, that's great, thank you for sharing, but please share this with the Worcester Police Department. Here's their information.
Thank you, Patrick Sargent. He is the founder of This Week in Worcester and creator and showrunner of Unsolved Worcester. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
And Laurel Onert, assistant teaching professor at Northeastern University. She's currently building this new class on true crime. I appreciate you being here, too.
Thank you.
You're listening to Radio Boston. I'm Yasmin Ammer, in for Tiziana Deering. Let's talk business. Despite inflation and the economic downturn many businesses faced during the pandemic, small businesses in the Commonwealth have steadily been increasing over the last 5 years. So let's touch on the state's entrepreneurial spirit and dive into what it takes to get a business off the ground, the challenges small businesses face, what resources are available to them, and whether they are just getting started or have been around for years. And to help us do that, we're joined now by Cliff Robbins. He's the senior business advisor of the Southeast Region Office of the Massachusetts Small Business Development Center Network. His organization helps small business owners and entrepreneurs in Massachusetts with the tools and guidance needed to be successful. Cliff, hi.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing fantastic. It's really nice to hear your voice.
And well, thank you for having me on.
Yeah, and we also have Theodora Skiadas. She's the executive director of Cambridge Local First, a nonprofit network of independent businesses in Cambridge that provide tech support and other services to help businesses thrive. Theodora, hi.
Hi, Yasmin. Thanks for having me on.
Yes, it's great to have you. And I want to start off the conversation by talking about what a small business is. That's firms employing fewer than 500 employees, just so we're clear. But Cliff, let's start with you. Can you tell me a little bit about how the Massachusetts Small Business Development Center, that's a mouthful, so MSBDC, works with small businesses? What do you do for them?
Well, we give them advice. I work with... We are full-time business advisors. I am, and my people are employed by the University of Massachusetts Amherst Eisenberg School of Business. We're paid. We're full-time. We work with people who either have a concept, want to start a business, people who have started a business, help them grow the business, help them sell the business, help people buy a business. We help business people grow their sales, profits. I work with some of the smartest business people I've ever worked with. I wish I had them when I started my own businesses 30 years ago. They're just tremendously, they're well-educated. We all have advanced degrees, but we all have experience, tremendous experience. Some of us have experience in banking. I'm a former business owner and builder. I built a $20 million business. I was a professor at Bentley, now university, then college. And I was hired about 20 years ago to work southeastern Massachusetts
and, Cliff,
and provide free business advice to people.
Sorry to interrupt you right there, but I am wondering, how much does this cost?
Free.
Free. There's
no charge.
We love to hear it.
We're funded by the SBA. And the state of Massachusetts, and they get a darn good return in new tax revenue and jobs created. And they monitor that every year to make sure that we create a lot of companies, hundreds of companies, create thousands of jobs, help people get tens of millions of dollars with the finance. So we help them write business plans.
Right.
We help them do their marketing plans. We help them at any stage they're at.
So a public service. So a public service is what you're saying.
That is correct.
Let me jump to Theo, because I want to also briefly know how Cambridge Local First supports independent businesses.
Sure. So we are a nonprofit network of about 500 locally and independently owned businesses in Cambridge and the surrounding area. And we're part of a national network of independent business alliances that are all advocating and supporting locally and independently owned businesses. Cambridge Local First was started around 2005, and we're part of a national movement that was created in response to declining retail businesses around the country. So we do three primary activities. We provide technical assistance to businesses. We provide education to the public on why it's so important to shop locally, which includes all kinds of partnerships. And we also do advocacy at the local, state, and federal levels. We also have an internship program that's national. And our interns have looked most recently on issues like economic vitality measures, monopoly reform, creating a gift guide, creating a BIPOC incubator, doing a procurement study, and measuring local economic multipliers.
So there's and ultimately... Oh, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but there's a lot there and there's a lot to discuss. And I do want to get to more about small businesses in Massachusetts. Cliff, just right back at you for just a second. There are about 700,000 small businesses in Massachusetts. And the number of small businesses just over the last few years, especially since the pandemic, more people have been thinking about it. Would you say the state is favorable for entrepreneurs?
Oh, absolutely. Very definitely. The state of Massachusetts understands that small businesses employ 90-something percent of the people who work in the state of Massachusetts actually work for a small business. So the state is very favorable to small business.
And Theo, I know you work primarily with businesses in Cambridge, but what are some things that people should consider when they're thinking about starting a small business?
Sure. Firstly, they should think about whether it's the right decision for them, because starting a business is a huge commitment. If they decide to move forward, they should contact their local governments because often they'll have a checklist of requirements. They'll need to apply for certain permits. If they plan to open an office or a physical storefront, they'll have to secure a spot. Sometimes a storefront database can be helpful here. They'll need to secure financing with a local bank, create a business plan, build out social media accounts, join a business association, and ultimately move toward opening the business.
Oh, it's like a map. You just laid out the map. But owning a small business is time-consuming and challenging. Our producer, Andrea Perdomo-Hernandez, recently spoke with business owner Jessica Diaz-Lara of Dorchester. She's the co-owner of the Flying Cow Party Essentials, and her company provides tents, tables, chairs, bouncy houses, other fun stuff to clients. And she describes some of the duties she finds herself doing as a business owner.
You are essentially doing everything. You're the customer service rep. You're helping out with the accountant. You're doing the invoices. You're doing organizing the books a little bit or the receipts. You're the social media contenter. You're the business administrator. You're the salesperson. And at the same time, you're also the logistic. You're the one that's physically doing things.
So more than just a great idea, I'm hearing. But Cliff, Theo touched upon some things. She laid out a map, but I do want to know what would you like people to know when they're planning to start a small business? What's the first thing you tell them?
The first thing I tell them is you really should write a business plan. And, you know, there's all kinds of help, all kinds of different models and templates that we use to try to help people flesh out the idea of how are they going to start their business, where are they going to get the money to do it, what is their risk tolerance. But the most important thing is how are they going to create customers. And the marketing piece of the business plan is absolutely critical to who are the customers, who are their target audience, and how are they going to reach them and convince them to come to them and give their business, the customers, give the money to them. Those are the important issues facing anybody trying to start or operate or grow a small business.
And again,
they really should be writing a plan and with help.
With help. So again, your organization, just to emphasize, your organization is willing to do that for businesses of all stages for free. You'll sit down and help write that business plan.
Absolutely. And we continually work and redevelop and redefine business plans with people at all stages.
Mm. We're speaking with Cliff Robbins of the Massachusetts Small Business Development Center and Theodora Skiadas of the Cambridge Local First about small businesses in the Commonwealth. Let's talk a little bit more about Challenge. Theo, Cambridge Local First provides tech services, education. What are some of the main challenges you're seeing that business owners are facing now?
Sure. So we see three primary challenges. The first is that retail businesses are closing around the country in part because of changing consumer preferences as consumers increasingly purchase retail goods from online providers like Amazon, which drives traffic away from our main streets and online. The second is multi-decade bank consolidation, which diminishes funds for local business development, as the consolidation means that bigger banks don't generally lend to small businesses in the same numbers because the loans are not as lucrative as the other ways in which they could use the funds. And third, an increasingly unstable and unaffordable commercial rental market compounds the problem. As international real estate and financial entities are increasingly investing in our cities and driving up commercial rents and displacing local businesses.
Oh, that is such a problem locally. It's an expensive, expensive rental market, not just for everyone. I mean, obviously also for businesses, but I'm glad you brought up all these challenges because I want to share a story that stuck with me about a business owner named Latricia Carter Stokes. She owns Stokes Barbecue Food Truck in Dorchester. She recently inherited the 20-year-old business from her father, but has not been able to operate the truck all year because she doesn't have the thousands of dollars to install a new exhaust fan, which she needs to pass inspection. And that's on top of all her other repairs and expenses. And so in the meantime, I mean, she's entrepreneurial. She didn't want to completely stop. She pivoted to catering, and that has not been easy either.
When you have to do, you know, events every week just to try to kind of make up money, you have to pay these organizations in order to be a part of it to make a profit. And I mean, that's just business. However, it's just a little harder for me to do these things and spread myself as wide as I'd like to. Because I can't really, I have to be a little tighter with the money.
So Cliff, going to you, it's this idea of you have to have money to make money. Are there resources out there to help someone like Latricia, you know, where she could get money to for things like repairs or just pay vendor fees? And I want to acknowledge something because according to a recent Mass Inc. polling group survey, business owners of color like Latricia, they have a much harder time getting loans and other capital for their businesses than their white counterparts. So what advice would you give Latricia? Where should she go?
Well, depending on where she is, we have all over the country institutions called community development corporations, and Theodore is dead right. There's a tightening credit going on with roll-ups of banks and the bigger banks. They're not interested in doing small local businesses like this one, but there are community development organizations. Theodore could probably tell you what's in Boston. I know that we have Southeastern Economic Development in Taunton. And their tagline should be, in my opinion, I'm a marketing guy, we may say yes if your bank says no. And they're in the business of helping people, particularly for microloans, SBA-backed microloans that can help people get over the hump, get the funding they need, and in this case, to get the truck, you know, re-outfitted, approved, and back on the road and making money for the owner.
So what you're saying is that there are alternatives to these banks, these big investors that you normally think of. There are other places to turn.
Correct.
And what about grants? Are they out there?
There used to be. There's not a lot of grants for for-profit businesses. There's sometimes local towns and cities and economic development people. I know New Bedford has a grant program, a small grant program for businesses in New Bedford. You know, the state of Massachusetts had a lot of grant opportunities, the Restaurant Revival Fund, and of course, the federal government had the Paycheck Protection Program, PPP, and they had the EIDL loans. But generally speaking, for for-profit businesses, no, there's not a lot of grant money out there for that. But there is availability if the people have a decent credit rating and can show the lender, I mean, it always comes down to show the lender how you're going to pay them back. And that's what we help people do, to put a pro forma plan together that says, this is what I'm going to sell, and this is how I'm going to pay you back.
Mm. And just to talk about these different stages, growth in and of itself, while a good thing, it also comes with its own set of problems. Let's go back to Jessica Diaz Lara, the co-owner of the Flying Cow Party Essentials, based in Dorchester. She told us about balancing demand and the resources that she has.
So right now we're in that little gray area where we're slowly growing, and for the growth to continue, we will need employees, but we just, because we are a small business, we're not fully there to cover the amount of employees to sustain the growth that we want to have.
Theo, I'd love to hear from your experience talking to businesses where in that when they're in that little gray area that Jessica was just talking about. Like, what advice do you have for them? How should they balance growth and I don't know, just a possible financial hardship?
It's a hard place to be. It can be helpful to have allies in city government who can help them maneuver complicated licensing and administrative procedures, and also allies in organizations like ours that are intended to provide guidance during these really difficult times. Sometimes, ultimately, it makes sense to close the business or it needs to pivot in a new way. Especially with the pandemic, a lot of our businesses have found themselves in gray places and have had to make really strategic pivots to stay alive.
And Cliff, could you give us another piece of advice? If somebody has this great idea and they're in Massachusetts, what is the first thing that they should do?
The first thing they should do is flesh out the idea. You know, they have a dream, they have an idea, and they should go and visit an SBDC advisor or a SCORE advisor or the folks, Theodora's folks, get some professional help to plan this business properly and launch the thing with a solid plan in place. And a solid plan for growth. And you're absolutely right. Hiring and retaining employees today is one of the biggest problems, along with inflation and the tightening of credit. There, I have a lot of clients who say to me, Cliff, I could continue to grow my business if I could get the people. And that's an issue that has to be addressed. And because you can't grow beyond what, you know, the number, the staff that you have currently.
Yeah. And Theo, even if you're not trying to start a small business, if you're just listening, I would love to hear you talk about the value of small businesses, why they're an important part of the local economy, briefly. Theo, are you with us? I think we lost Theo, but that's okay. We've been talking with Theo and Clifford Robbins. I want to say, Cliff, thank you so much, since we still have you on.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on. I enjoyed it very much. It's good to get the message out there to people that there's a lot of help.
There's a lot of free help.
You bet. No charge.
He's the senior business advisor of the Massachusetts Small Business Development Center Network. That's a state organization that provides information and support for businesses. And we had on the line with us Theodora Skiatis. She's the executive director of Cambridge Local First, a nonprofit network of independent businesses in Cambridge that give tech support and other services to help businesses thrive. It's another installment of Brilliant Boston, where we bring you into some of the most popular classes in our region's many, many universities. Last time it was a Berklee College of Music class that included making music out of brainwaves. But today we're going to Harvard, to the Harvard Divinity School specifically, where Professor Matthew Ichihashi Potts teaches a popular class called Forgiveness. And he's also the author of the book Forgiveness, An Alternative Account. It's a simple word, but a difficult concept. Matt, welcome. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Yasmin, for having me here.
Let's start with what made you want to focus on forgiveness.
Well, I mean, lots of things. I mean, maybe the biggest thing is that forgiveness intersects our lives in so many different ways. I mean, every one of us, because wrongdoing is a part of our lives, dealing with wrongdoing is a part of our lives. And I think people are able to think about and interact with forgiveness in every part of their life, personally, interpersonally, but also politically, socially, because wrong is a part of human experience, dealing with wrong is a part of human experience. And so it's just it's kind of a limitless topic for me. There's lots to explore and consider.
And I have to say, I am personally psyched you're here today.
Oh, good.
Our executive producer was making fun of me early because we had this one day where we were sharing toxic traits.
Okay.
And mine is I hold grudges.
Okay.
So this is really good for me. I'm the grudge holder.
Yeah.
But forgiveness, just to, you know, bring this back down, forgiveness is a big ask. And especially when the harm humans can do to one another. I mean, we heard earlier in the show about families in Worcester. Sometimes their families go through unimaginable violence. And so I want to know, how do you contemplate forgiveness when the harm is so immense?
Yeah. I mean, that's a real important question. I think you said that forgiveness is a big ask. I think it's important for us to think about what we're asking when we ask someone to forgive or when we ask for forgiveness, right? In my view, and this is one of the things we cover in the class, at least in the last few hundred years, other kind of related concepts have seeped into forgiveness. Things like giving up anger or giving up grudges are understood as being the same thing as forgiveness. Or reconciling with someone is understood to be the same thing as forgiveness. I'm not sure those things should be the same thing. I think that maybe it's possible to forgive someone while still being angry at them. Maybe it's possible to forgive someone without being ready to reconcile with them. And part of what the course and my work tries to explore is, what is that moral space which allows us to still be angry or to still mistrust someone or not ready to reconcile, but for us also say, like, I don't want any more violence. I want to move on. Like, maybe anger and processing anger is part of moving on. Maybe building trust and moving towards reconciliation is part of moving on. For me, forgiveness is more about turning away from, like, retributive violence or retributive harm and less about, like, policing my own emotions or forcing myself to reconcile with someone who hasn't earned it yet. And in that sense, forgiveness is this really important moral concept because it preserves the agency of victims to decide when and how they want to reconcile, when and how they want to feel, with also giving them an opportunity to move beyond the past and move beyond the harms of the past in a real and realizable way.
That's interesting. You're really distilling it, because I think I also merged forgiveness, the concept of forgiveness, with other things like reconciliation.
Yeah.
And just controlling your own emotion. But we asked our audience for their thoughts on forgiveness, and we got this response from Rose in Alexandria, Virginia. And if you want to join our texting club to share your thoughts with the show, it's a really interesting topic. Text the word Boston to 617-766-0382. So Rose says, really, forgiveness seems to be just accepting that things are now different than the way you wanted them, and it's moving on to a new chapter with or without the person who was involved in the disappointing situation. Sometimes we can do it, and sometimes we can't. What do you think about that?
I mean, I love that. Thank you, Rose. I feel like Rose encapsulated my position on it, like, more efficiently than my 200-page book, right? I think one of the things I say in my book is that I feel like forgiveness is often aligned with, like, it's thought to be miraculous or magical. But one of the things I say is actually more like mourning. It's moving beyond something we can't undo, right? It's not undoing something that can't be undone. It's actually taking a posture towards a past that can't be undone and trying to figure out, how do we move on into a future, right? And in that sense, you know, the same way mourning is a good, not because it feels good, but because it's the way we deal with an irrevocable past or something that's lost that can't be regained. Forgiveness takes a position on the past which says, like, hey, this can't be undone. The harm that was caused is a fact that can't be undone. But what we can do is try to move on into a future. And forgiveness is one of the strategies, I think, that we can use to move into that future. So what Rose said about realizing that what's been done can't be undone, I think that's crucial to any effective or just form of forgiveness.
Mm. And I think a lot of people listening, and you're coming at this from also a Christian tradition,
yeah,
I should mention, and I think a lot of the people listening will be thinking of these two ideas that come out of that tradition,
yeah,
an eye for an eye, and then another one, turn the other cheek.
Yeah.
Are those two in tension?
Yeah, they are in tension. I think that's hard not to see them in tension. So the eye for the eye teaching comes from the Hebrew scriptures. It tries to suggest, I think, on my reading of it, it tries to suggest a kind of equality. I mean, you think about when this law was first given, you know, a rich man could do anything he wanted to a poor man, right? The idea that every person's eye is worth the same as another person's eye, I think that's part of the equality that is built into that teaching. What's difficult about that teaching, or challenging about that teaching, is if we interpret it to mean that punishment is demanded when harm is caused. Like, if you harm me, I must harm you in return. Mm-hmm. What I would like to do is think about, you know, think about what other ways can we think about equity and equality. If the real heart of the ancient teaching is about the equality of persons, then how can we think about a justice system that moves beyond simple equations of harm for harm's sake or harm in return for harm and towards other forms of justice, which can be about moving on to the future, supporting a whole community? And I think practices which promote peace and non-retributive, like more like restorative forms of justice, actually do better kind of lean into the equality of persons, the equal dignity of persons. And forgiveness can be a part of that sort of practice.
So context really matters here, and a big part of it is the message behind an eye for an eye.
I think that's right.
The quality message.
That's right. I mean, when Jesus, the other teaching comes from Jesus' Sermon on the Mount when he says, you know, you have heard it said, you know, an eye for an eye, I say to you, love your enemy, turn the other cheek. I think what he's trying to do, and he says that's a fulfillment of the ancient teaching, not an abrogation of it. And I think what he's trying to suggest is that each person is equally beloved of God, to use more theological language. Each person, even your enemy, matters as much to God as you do. That's the sense in which we're equal. Therefore, when you are trying to move on from harm or wrongdoing, treat that person as if they are as beloved as you are. And that's where the kind of the equality of the ancient teaching, I think, shines through, or could be understood to shine through in my particular interpretation.
So our community, obviously, you know, multi-religious, some non-religious, everything in between. And I want to talk a little bit about different, not forms of forgiveness, but different approaches to forgiveness. Yep. I can speak, you know, growing up in a Muslim home, forgiveness was always, at least in my house, I can't speak on it theologically, but it was always, you have to seek for forgiveness before you do anything big that is religious. Like, for example, like if you are going to pilgrimage, you're going to have to ask everyone you've ever done wrong for forgiveness. And this idea of always asking your parents for forgiveness. And so the burden, if you will, is always placed on the potential wrongdoer.
Yeah.
And you're even asking for forgiveness for things that you didn't know you did.
Yeah.
I want to hear, like, what other traditions you've been thinking about when it comes to forgiveness.
I mean, this is one of my real concerns with forgiveness is that, you know, in the wake of wrongdoing, it transfers moral responsibility for repairing the harm from the offender to the victim. Like, now the obligation is upon the person who was harmed to make it right. And that doesn't seem right to me. There are lots of different traditions. I mean, one tradition that's interesting to me, I'm half Japanese. My mom is from Japan. And although I'm not a Buddhist, I have some familiarity with the Buddhist tradition. Within the Buddhist tradition, you know, there's no real direct translation to forgiveness, the language of forgiveness. And even within Christianity, the English word we use for forgiveness, it doesn't really translate the ancient concepts as directly as we might think. But within the Buddhist tradition, there's a sense of forbearance, of patience. So, like, when someone harms you, the idea of forbearance or like restraint from retaliation, I think that's very similar to the way I'm thinking about forgiveness as well, which is not about, again, letting go of grudges or reconciling too hastily, but about sort of showing patience and endurance and forbearance when someone harms you, forbearance and reluctance to retaliate in response. And that sort of establishing the conditions for a way of moving on that is peaceful, to me, it's really at stake in it. And we can look to other traditions to help us think through what that might mean for us.
I'm just hearing, you know, become a higher version of yourself. Yeah. That's really it. It's a really beautiful way to think about it. But to our listeners, we're speaking with Matthew Echahasi Potts. He's the Plummer Professor of Christian Morals at Harvard Divinity School and a professor of the popular class on forgiveness. So let's shift here to societal versus interpersonal harm, because, you know, it's one thing to consider interpersonal harm and like these maybe sometimes petty grudges you hold against people, but then we can talk about structural harm, especially when it's perpetrated on whole groups of people, racist oppression, patriarchal oppression. And I want to hear how you approach those two concepts. How do you forgive in that context?
Yeah, and this is one of the things I think is really important to me, and another reason why I wanted to do some research and do some writing on forgiveness, because a lot of the critiques of forgiveness that exist in the scholarship today are coming out of activist communities. right? Mm-hmm. Are coming out of communities that are saying, like, we're not ready to give up our anger. We are angry. Anger is actually a sign that we have been harmed, and anger is something we want to hold on to. You ought to deal with our anger because it's us telling you something is wrong, right? Or we're not ready to reconcile. Like, you need to earn that. Why ought we to trust you if you haven't earned this? To me, what's really important in that is I want to open up the possibility, especially because forgiveness is such a weighty moral concept, because in so many of our cultures and so many of our lives, it is something we feel we are obligated to do. I want to give people freedom to feel anger, freedom to say, I do not trust you, and I don't have a reason to trust you yet, while they're also saying, but I'm not going to retaliate. I mean, I think about sort of the Black Lives Matter protest after the murder of George Floyd, and I think about people in the street who are protesting peacefully, but expressing anger, saying there is something wrong, right? But also saying we are not going to rise up in violence. We're going to protest peacefully and demand change with anger, right? I think that being able to understand that, I don't want to, you know, force language upon anybody who doesn't want to use it. But for me, that to me, that's a fundamentally peaceful commitment. It's one that's angry. It's one that demands a just reconciliation, but it's also one that isn't willing to, you know, say everything's fine, everything's okay. You know, forgive and forget's not something I like. Forgiveness as like a way of saying, oh, it's all okay now, it's all over. That's not something I like. I think going out to the streets peacefully and demanding change, even while angry, I want to say that is a moral accomplishment. This is a group of people who on one on one understanding might have the right to expect or want vengeance, but they are turning away from acts of vengeance and instead demanding a better world. That's, to me, that's really what's at stake in forgiveness. And one of the reasons I want to write this book and teach this class is to invite people who are doing that work to think about their work as within the umbrella of that big, moral, important category of forgiveness.
And so I want to do one more comment from a listener. This is from your Yolette Randolph, and she's talking about forgiveness as a freedom. To me, forgiveness means freedom, and until you forgive, I think you imprison yourself. Yeah. It's hard to forgive, though, because it hurts, but you should force yourself to set aside the pain. I think that often hurt people. Deep down, those who hurt us are themselves hurting in some way. And that's an interesting comment. Yeah. I want to know what you hear about that, especially. You should force yourself to set aside the pain because we've been talking about that. How do you?
I think it depends what you mean by set aside. I think that we can't stifle pain. I think we need to process pain in healthy ways. But Yolette's comment really reminds me of a philosopher I lean pretty heavily upon in my book named Hannah Arendt. And she talks about forgiveness as a kind of freedom. She worries that we can get embroiled in these cycles of retributive violence and that the kind of violence and retributive violence can go back and forth like a cycle of retribution, which we can't escape. And she says, like, one of the signs of the human's capacity to be free and to act in the world is that we can decide not to hurt somebody back and try something different. And it really is a way of freeing yourself from the past. Now, it doesn't mean the past never happened. Freeing yourself from the past doesn't mean you forget. It means that you are willing to move on given the past that you have and understanding the wounds that you're going to bear going into your future.
Thank you so much. This was such an interesting conversation. I feel a lot better about how I approach forgiveness personally. But that was Matthew Ichihashi Potts. He is a Harvard Divinity School plumber, professor of Christian morals, and author of the book Forgiveness, An Alternative Account. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Yasmin.
And having this conversation. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Chris Siderek, Amanda Beeland, and Sydney Bowles, with Bart Tachi and Andrea Perdomo Hernandez. Marquise Neal is our senior technical director. Titus Faladun is our executive producer. I'm Yasmin Ammer. Tiziana Deering will be back with you tomorrow for more Radio Boston.